Okay, Martin Summers, Every Man by Philip Roth.
Well, this isn't a lecture with Q&As. It's more a conversation. I first want to ask, how many people have read Roth before? Does make a difference.
We did have the other Roth book in the book club a few months ago.
The Plot Against America.
Plot Against America.
Ah, yeah. How many people have read Roth apart from Plot Against America? Does make a big difference. Okay. I'm not going to talk about Roth a lot, but I should say as a warning, when I was reading, I think it was last month's issue of Prospect, and four or six writers said that Philip Roth's book was one of the most overrated in 2006. Personally, I think it's a wonderful book, and I adore Roth, but it's very easy to look at Roth, put this to a question, as of merely providing book-length excuses for aging sexual predators. And indeed, this, The Human Stain, The Dying Animal, indeed quite a lot of Roth's books are about men getting old, and basically, I am using his own phrase, being self-confessed content. Much of Roth's books could be read in a certain way as a huge excuse. I'm not sure how much of this reflects Roth's own life, but it can very easily be read as a way for men typically in their 70s, 80s, facing death, and looking back on a life of not exactly virtue, but of living life to the full in certain ways. But I'll go into some of that in more depth. I thought there might be roughly four areas of discussion, at least, that I picked up on. First is the inevitable, is it all about 9/11 in some way? Secondly, the notion of perfectibility, as exemplified by his brother Howie. And that goes hand in hand with the notion of what is the good life? Is it the same as having led a virtuous or ethical life? And Roth clearly disagrees. Thirdly, one could look at it as a treatment about forgiveness, sympathy, and the acceptance of reality, and not just raging against imagined or real hurts that happened some time ago, which clearly his ex-wives and his two sons continue to be gripped by. The fourth one is about, I guess you call it, the nature of man, if they're not necessarily male, and what you might call the ebb and flow of the life force. Not quite in order, I'm just going to offer some questions here. And this is a really tired one, but I just felt I had to ask it. It's the question about how much do you want to see this as a 9/11 parable? There are quite a few bits, particularly between, I think it's about page 66 and 72, about 9/11. About how he moves away from Manhattan, which you consider to be the life force of America, and he moves to the Starfish Retirement Village. Is this his own sense of him dying and his life force ebbing away? Is this some grand parallel metaphor for the waning of America? And so on. I felt I had to put that in there because almost anything written after 9/11, particularly by a prominent American author, is regarded as inevitably about 9/11. But he does make quite a lot of repeated references to 9/11. It's crucial when he's talking about leaving Manhattan, and he even talks about his surgeons looking like terrorists because of the masks and on. There's lots of references to feeling vulnerable in Manhattan, and the fact is, of course, when he gets to Starfish Village, he actually feels his most vulnerable and most lonely and most terrified and most aware of his failing flesh and that of all the people around him. The second thing is, how much could you really want to see this as Roth's own personal endorsement or sympathy about living the good life? And also the extent to which it's partly about him talking about being an artist and the creative process. I was particularly struck by just how unsympathetic Roth is to Nancy's first husband, who's the hopeless, irresponsible, almost stroppy teenager-like, the self-described, right, so anti-commercial poet. And he, and again, I reflect, you can think about the hopeless poet and also his own painting glasses. Where he's constantly talking about all these people who just seem to have no attitude at all, or this odd sense of them not applying themselves to life, or they rather they can't apply themselves to painting. And he invokes, and I presume this is true, he invokes something that the artist Chuck Close said, amateurs look for inspiration, the rest of us just to get up and go to work. Now again, I'm not sure if I'm reading too much into this, but there's a sense that our protagonist in this book has never waited around looking for inspiration. He's never felt to have a particular vocation in life in a strong sense, but he's just got on in a fairly, with a certain amount of vigour, and just got on with his life. But he certainly contrasts that with a great deal of envy with Howie, who he finds to be the almost epitome of the American Wasp, of a man who's staggeringly successful, rich, has a varied life, is constantly stimulated, is successfully married, and so on. And there's that quite strong contrast with Howie. And indeed, the couple mentioned when he's at Starfish, when there's that very moving thing about the woman who's actually the one good artist there, who eventually takes an overdose of sleeping pills, who describes how her life was just driven by this huge sense of and of inspiration and passion and so on. And she eventually, because she can't have that anymore, she takes an overdose. So again, I'm not sure how tenuous this is, or whether this is just a very personal tale about dying and looking back on whether you've had a good life or not. One of the other themes is the notion of forgiveness and moving on. He's phenomenally critical, particularly of his sons, and who never seem to have accepted the reality of life or the reality of marriage and then divorce. And he's, which I think in many ways some of the strongest bits of the novel, but he has this rant on page 97. I'm not even sure if you call it a rant, because that seems bad. Where he, I'm not quite sure who he's supposed to be shouting out at, but he has this rant about, you wicked bastards, you sulky fuckers, you condemning little shits. Would everything be different? He asked himself, if I'd been different, done things differently, would it all be less lonely than it is now? Of course it would. But this is what I did. I am 71. This is the man I have made. This is what I did to get here, and there's nothing more to be said. And there's quite... And his sons continue to hold a great grudge against him and do not forgive him. But his daughter's completely different, and he still has a, it seems, a wonderful, loving relationship with his daughter. There's a few other points. Roth is remarkably open-ended about something that Phoebe says to him repeatedly on page 122, which is Roth, I presume like so many men, she means, the man loses the passion for the marriage and he cannot live without. The wife is pragmatic, the wife is realistic. Yes, the passion is gone, she's older and not what she was, but to her it's not enough to have the physical affection. Just being there with him in the bed, she holding him, he holding her. The physical affection, the tenderness, the camaraderie, the closeness. But he cannot accept that because he is a man who, in italics, cannot live without. I'm not really sure whether this is just a way of saying you're a man who cannot live without constantly chasing young women. You're a man who cannot live without the prospect of a younger sexual partner, or the prospect of change. I'm not quite sure what this living without is. Is this just his wife being a way of... I'm not quite... I'm really not sure whether Roth is trying to make this something else. Perhaps it's the case he does not want to too closely associate the sense of without just saying it's just about sex or it's just about the chase. I think he clearly is quite obsessed about this notion of life force, though he doesn't actually use the phrase. Something about life force, that the sense you've got to be impelled to go, you've impelled somewhere or towards something, and not necessarily someone. But again, it's not very clear, and I'm never quite sure what Roth's trying to celebrate in this. Is he being forgiving towards, or indulgent towards, the rascal, the Richard Harris-style character, the man who just lives freely and we can sort of indulge our sort of fantasies about somebody like that? It's not quite clear what he's wanting us to celebrate or indulge, or indeed if we're supposed to forgive or indulge. My other point is, I think this goes along with this issue of sympathy and the notion of having lived a good life, is the notion of perfectibility. The notion of perfectibility is run through American religion and ethics, and indeed aesthetics, or rather personal aesthetics, for almost 100 years. It's always been a very strong thing in American culture. And how he represents that perfectibility. You could almost imagine how his CV as being Harvard Law School, a Wharton MBA, running Latin America at the age of 27, and just astonishing range of sports awards, work for the local community, and almost being unassailable in terms of reputation, and worse, at least for our protagonist, is that Howie's a really nice guy and he's genuine. And it's actually the point that it's the protagonist's failing health is the only thing that eventually tips him into really hating Howie, because he can't bear the thought of Howie never getting ill, never going to hospital. And when I was reading this, I was very much reminded of two of Richard Ford's books. I forgot what their names are. The Sports Writer and Independence Day, and there's the latest one. And similarly, they're remarkably forgiving, tender, and quite careful about portraying a man who has not lived an incredibly good life, but has just tried to get by with a certain degree of compassion, vigour, and so on, but certainly not somebody who could be regarded all round as being quite a good father, a good father, a good husband, a good lover, good parent, however you want to understand it. The Richard Ford stuff, by the way, is really good and quite a good, it's very complimentary to much what Roth's written. And ultimately, this is called Everyman. And indeed, Richard Ford's stuff is even more about, quotes, Everyman. And at the end of this, I thought it was a really well written and occasionally very moving book. But I'm not really sure how profound or metaphysical it's supposed to be, tries to be, or indeed really how slight we should regard it. And I think one of the things that came out in this prospect list of overrated things of the year, and indeed underrated, was that a lot of people thought this was a slight work of fiction, partly because it wasn't a sort of vast, heavyweight thing that typically gets submitted for the National Book Award. I didn't think it was slight. But I certainly doubt whether it counts as a great work of literature, but I found it profoundly moving. And I'm not really quite sure whether just how profound or indeed good it is.
Thank you, Martin.